Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, your host. My guest today is Neil Franklin, the Executive Director of LEAP. Welcome, Neil. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
What you advocate is that the current drug laws are not working, but also some major changes.
Yeah.
Well, first off, let me hear a bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a 33-year law enforcement veteran in the state of Maryland. And I began my career in the late 70s with the Maryland State Police. I did most of my work either in drug enforcement or criminal investigation. I worked undercover in the early 80s in the Washington, D.C. metro area in southern Maryland. Did a little bit of work also undercover here in Baltimore in some of the joint efforts that we had going on. And moved up through the ranks and started commanding multi-jurisdictional drug task forces. Eventually went into training and became the commander of training for the Maryland State Police and retired in 1999 from there and came to Baltimore, which is my hometown, actually. Grew up in Baltimore and became the director of training for the Baltimore Police Department for 4 years up until 2004. And then I went with my last law enforcement agency, which was Maryland Transit, and I was with them for 6 years. Commanded the Detective Bureau for them, as well as Chief of Patrol and some other things. And some people say, I just can't keep a job. Now I'm the Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
So tell me a bit about LEAP and how you got into it.
Well, LEAP is 11 years old. It's relatively young in the world of nonprofit organizations. We're a 501c3 educational organization. And as I said, we're international. We actually have branches in six other countries, such as Canada, Costa Rica, a couple over in Europe, Australia, Brazil. And we are comprised of law enforcement professionals. So that can be cops, judges, criminal prosecutors, corrections officials. We have active prison wardens. We have active prosecutors on board. Most of us are retired. And that's for an obvious reason, the political pressures of being in law enforcement and advocating for what we do, which is an end to prohibition. And some of your listeners are probably wondering, end of prohibition? Didn't we end that back in 1933 when we ended alcohol prohibition and repealed the 18th Amendment? Well, we're talking about the prohibition of drugs. So we've been here once before trying to prohibit something that people want to use, despite what your personal feelings are about drugs. And like back in the 1920s, we ended up with violence in our streets. We gave birth to Al Capone and Bugsy Siegel and bolstered their criminal enterprises with bootlegging, St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Many people are familiar with that. And we had the very same thing in our streets today with drugs such as marijuana, heroin, cocaine, and so on. So we have the shootings, we have the drive-by shootings, we have the running gun battles, we have the drug gangs trying to corner the market, we have the cartel in Central America. And we have come to realize in our organization that in order to reduce this crime, disease, death, and addiction, that we have to do what we did back in the 1920s, so 1933, and that's to end alcohol, I'm sorry, to end the prohibition of drugs, period, and figure out a way to regulate and control these drugs, similar to what they are now doing in Washington State and Colorado with marijuana.
Can you fill us in on what they're doing, those two states?
Well, in November, now, this is very important, the people of those states decided that it was time to end the war on marijuana. It was time to end the prohibition of marijuana. So they wrote it, passed a referendum in both states to move marijuana from the criminal marketplace into one that is legalized, regulated, and controlled by the people. And literally what that does, it is removing the profits of marijuana sales from the criminal marketplace, from organized crime, from local gangs, from the cartel, and taxing, regulating it. It will now help the state economy in Washington and Colorado. It will now do a better job of keeping marijuana away from our children. Just like alcohol, we can't keep it completely away from our children, but we'll do a much better job managing it ourselves than allowing criminals to manage it. So that's pretty much what they've done. And now they are actually working on the actual regulatory scheme. So what would it look like? You know, how would it be produced? What quality control measures will be in place and how it will be sold on a retail market? Right off the bat, the city attorney for the city of Seattle and for King County in Washington stopped making or prosecuting people for marijuana arrests, for possession arrests. The hundreds of cases that were on the books, they dismissed. Right away, the lives of those people has improved dramatically, because I think we all know how difficult it is to get a job if you've got any type of conviction, but more so if it's a drug-related conviction on your record. It really stifles your life. It hampers your chances of getting a student loan for college, assistance for public housing, and other benefits that people may need to help them get on their feet to move forward in life. So the lives of many people have gotten better since November in Washington and Colorado.
That's terrific. Can you tell me about who are your supporters in LEAP? You say on your website it says, like yourself, former police officers, and there's judges.
Yeah, we have former police officers, chiefs of police at all levels within a police department, from the chief all the way down to the patrol officer. We have criminal prosecutors. We have federal prosecutors. We have prison wardens. We have an active prison warden, Rick Van Wickler, who is in Chester County, New Hampshire. And he runs a prison there, and he's one of our most dynamic speakers that we have for the organization. We have judges, Supreme Court Judge Jim Gray out in California, Maria Lucia Caram down in Brazil. We have on our advisory board former drug czars and from other countries and government officials, senators, and other representatives. So we run the gambit of anyone who's had anything to do at all levels of government with enforcing these current policies, drug policies that we have in place.
And what would you say would be just roughly the percentage of the total of people like police officers and what you just mentioned who are advocates of the same type of,
you know? Well, we have over 100,000 supporters worldwide. Now, that's anyone from any walk of life. And that's growing literally, no pun intended, by leaps and bounds every year as people learn more and more about us. And for your listeners who are listening right now, go to our website and follow along with me at www.leap.cc. And we have probably about 5,000 law enforcement professionals among our ranks. And that's growing, especially since the elections in Washington and Colorado, and more people started learning more about our organization, and we really grew substantially.
You've seen a marketed jump?
Yeah, yeah.
Since then?
Yeah. Our Facebook page has literally gone through the roof, and we have a wonderful, wonderful YouTube channel with great videos on it of our speakers talking about this issue. It's a vast issue. And literally, Dave, I could talk to you probably for the next 2 days for a couple hours each
time,
day
no
on this topic, because it's so far-reaching. It has so many tentacles.
And it's not anywhere near completion. I mean, you're going, growing leaps and bounds daily.
Yeah, we've got a lot of work to do. Long road ahead of us.
Can you describe some of your programs and strategies?
Well, one of the main things we do, and like I said before, we're a nonprofit 501c3 educational organization. So we have a speakers bureau of about 160 of the cream of the crop who travel the globe and speak to organizations, different groups, policymakers, delegates, senators. We're down on Capitol Hill quite a bit in Washington, D.C., and we're educating people, number one, about the failures of these policies. As a matter of fact, they were dead on arrival 42 years ago when Richard Nixon introduced them, you know, his war on drugs, as we put it. And so our speakers bureau, and on our website, you can request one of our speakers to come to your organization. We speak to Rotaries. We speak to Kiwanis Clubs. We speak to colleges and universities, from the local community college all the way up to Harvard University. And we educate, number one, regarding the failures of the policy. Number two, regarding the need to move in another direction. We don't advocate for a specific scheme of regulation and control. We believe that should be left up to the people of a particular community. For instance, with our alcohol regulations across the country, you go from state to state and county to county, you're going to find different policies and different regulations. It's up to the people to determine what would work for their individual communities and the challenges that they have within their communities. But that's primarily what we do. And in that process of educating people, we can then instruct them on how to act, how to engage their policymakers, how to write letters to their senators and delegates at the local level all the way up to the federal level. What to say, what are some of the talking points, what's some of the data you need to point out, what it's costing us, how many people we're sending to prison. For instance, the United States of America, which is supposed to be the land of the free, we incarcerate more people in this country than any other country around the globe. The United States has 5% of the world's population, yet we incarcerate almost 25% of the world's prisoners. Something's wrong with that picture. We have prison privatization, which is growing like crazy. You can invest in human bodies being incarcerated. And in democratic society, that should be unheard of. We should not be able to invest in companies on the New York Stock Exchange, the prisons that they run, and the people that they warehouse. It's just wrong.
The perception since LEAP came into existence about 11 years ago, and what you just described, you seem that throughout the 11 years you've learned a lot, and there are volumes of things you're doing right now as opposed to when you started. But the perception, you mentioned about the two states, but just generally, when you go into other countries, when you go into different parts of, let's say, more conservative areas of the U.S., have you gotten a pretty good perception there?
Yeah, we have, but it seems to be different things for different people. You know, some people are interested in the fact that the war on drugs is responsible for our boom in incarceration for a lot of these nonviolent drug offenses and ruining the lives of people and their families. When you send someone to prison, you send a family to prison. And then there are other parts of America that are primarily interested in what it's costing us. So over the past four decades, somewhere around $1.3 trillion is what we spent on enforcement thus far.
Jeez.
Jeffrey Miron, who is a Harvard economist, did a study a few years back. And I think his most recent study was in 2010, where it's around $50 billion every year we're spending on enforcement. You know, police, judges, corrections, parole and probation. And that's just on this drug war. And so, can you imagine what we could do with just one-third of that money as it relates to on-demand treatment? You know, instead of sending someone to prison who has a drug addiction problem, how about sending them immediately to treatment?
Well, that's what you advocate, too, that it's not really about, getting people off drugs for that sake. It's a health issue.
It's a
health issue.
Absolutely.
So I was trying to say it's not a criminal issue. It's a health issue.
Absolutely, and that's what that's one of the facts that we try to make to people and get them to understand. You know, I always ask this question: why is it that we treat someone so differently, someone who's addicted to alcohol, than someone who's addicted to heroin? You know, they're both suffering from the illness of addiction. It's just two different substances, but yet, in one hand, that person is covered under their medical program, and they can go get treatment and what they need to battle that illness. On the other hand, a person suffering from heroin addiction, we prosecute them criminally and we put them in prison, where we know they don't get the help that they need, and they come back out. Now they've got in addition to dealing with addiction, now they've got a conviction, something that they'll never get beyond, never get over. And as they struggle to get to upright their lives, they can't get employment, which sends them into the spiral. And so where does that leave them? It leaves them back in the streets, hired by the one organization that will hire just about anybody, and that's the drug trade.
Well, it's perception, I think, too. It's going to be hard to when you equate alcoholism and heroin addiction, you have people in your family, everybody's, who not addicted to alcohol, but they drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that's seen differently from the horrible heroin addict who's on the street robbing you and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
so that perception to change.
It's seen differently because that's what we portrayed. First of all, when people think of, like you just mentioned, Dave, the average heroin addict on the streets robbing and stealing from people, to feed their addiction, that's not because they're addicted. That's because of the policies of prohibition we have in place. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is if we had a system in place where that person could get what they needed, that the heroin was not cut with things and substances that are more dangerous than the drug itself. If they had, let me give you an example. Switzerland has heroin maintenance clinics. So those addicts who are addicted to heroin can go to these clinics. They pay what they can afford, and if they can't afford anything, you know what? They don't pay anything. They get pharmaceutical grade heroin, so they know the purity level of it. They know that it's not cut with something that's going to harm them. They administer it under medical supervision. They have zero overdose death. They're no longer spreading AIDS, throughout the community. And they're not committing crimes. They're not robbing. They're not stealing from people. They're able to live with their families because they don't have to lie anymore. They know for two or three times a day they're going to get the fix that they need. They're not wanting to get high. They're beyond that wanting to get high thing. They just don't want to get sick from missing a dose. So they're no longer committing the crimes. They're no longer robbing people, committing the burglaries. Many of them are gainfully employed. So now they're contributors to society. Now they're living with their family. Now they have relationships with their family. Now they're paying taxes. And you know what? When they get tired of looking in that mirror every day, two or three times a day, putting that needle in their arms, they can then get on-demand treatment at the same facility. And many of them have beat their addiction. Why we can't get it in our minds here that that's the way to go, as you said, Dave, it's a health issue. And if we treat it like a health issue, then we're going to have better progress in beating drug abuse. So that's just an example of what we could do if we could get beyond the stigma, if we could get beyond this image that we have in our minds, if we get beyond our own self issues of morality, and move past that and really focus on it from the facts, from a medical perspective, and it could just be so much better.
It's interesting. Because it's not just one thing. If what you say happens, and my feeling is that I think it would remarkably improve things. I don't want to take sides, but it's my radio station. I can do what I want.
That's true. I mean,
but think about that. It's not just the person that is taking drugs. Yeah. Like you say, it's the family. It's the people that, are criminals that are involved with it. It's all this. And what boggles my mind is that, it's an easy road to go into, I think. I'm I spent the last 10 years living in Northern Ireland, and some of the people, the criminality there sometimes kind of masks as patriotism and such, but you know, there, and I'm not saying that for everything, so don't get angry at me, people in Northern Ireland, okay, please, but there are people that are, the criminal of choice is drugs.
Yeah.
So it's everywhere. It's not just one place.
Right.
Well, my question to you is, now you've been at it 11 years, you're changing perceptions, why aren't people listening? I mean, is it, it seems like when you see quotes from the drug czar saying, you know, we're never going to do this, and for 42 years it hasn't worked, and everybody's regime is a drug czar, it hasn't worked, and yet they still think it will work. I mean, how do you change that?
Well, people are listening. The question is, are they acting? What are they doing with the information we give them? Even a drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, he's listening. And here's an example. They are now saying what we have been saying for a long time. Number one, can't arrest your way out of this problem. Number two, it is a health issue primarily, and we have to treat it as such. So their rhetoric is now changing. You know, they're no longer on this enforcement bandwagon. However, their dollars have not changed yet. The funding is still heavily weighted on the enforcement side. It's slowly changing, but it should be changing a lot faster, a lot quicker. So, they're listening. And the public's really listening. Unfortunately, we have a big voice, but we need a bigger voice in sharing this information. Information like, the average person believes that if we legalize, regulated, and controlled drugs, that more drugs would be made available to our children. But let me share something with your listeners that most people don't realize, but I sure do because I've been in this business for 3 decades. If we were to design a system of drug distribution that would make drugs available to our children at the highest level, you know what? We already have it. This is why. Because the system of prohibition is so lucrative. Anyone who needs money, anyone who can't find a job, and even those who do have good jobs, because so much money can be made, get into the drug dealing business. Because of that, we have literally, here we sit in Baltimore. Dave, I can walk out of your studio here and in a matter of minutes find any drug that I need because I can find a drug dealer on just about any corner in this city. That's because of prohibition. Now, drug dealers on every corner. Drug dealers are not going to ask your children, they're not going to ask anyone for ID to demonstrate that they're 21 years of age or older. They're going to sell to anyone who has the money. Not only will they sell to our children, they hire children into their businesses to sell drugs to other children. They have better recruitment programs than Fortune 500 companies.
Let me tell you a little story, and I hold that thought because
I
lived up on Pratt Street here between Washington and Wolf, and in the early 90s, since it was a major thoroughfare, there was a lot of drug dealers around. A lot of drug dealers. I was on the corner of an alley street, so all day long I would be hearing 50, 50, and there would be people on my stoop all the time. And I had to be very diplomatic in kicking them off because I couldn't be there all day long and that kind of stuff. And it was somewhat dangerous, but I had a job that went to 9 o'clock and they seemed to work mostly during happy hour, 5 to 9. Well, I guess when all the cars are coming home and such like that. But one day, they were getting a little perturbed at me because I kept kicking them off. But one day I got a knock at the door and this guy comes in and he says, I understand you have a problem with our people on the steps. They had their own community liaison officer.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And he said, if I lived in the neighborhood and they were all my stuff, I'd be upset too. Let's see what we could do about it. And I thought, wait a minute, am I talking to, you know, the drug lords, their staff? You know?
Yeah.
But it was, it took about 8 months for undercover work to get them off there. But I would come home night and they would be 10 or 12 of them on the stoops next door to me. There was a house, a drug house. One night they shot up the air conditioner and such like that. And I was trying to get, the police to do something. And they say, well, we have to go undercover. And eventually they did. Mm-hmm. But I remember the summer of 94 was, I would just go up in
but
my room.
You know
room.
What? They just moved to another, someone else's steps.
That's right.
You know, around a corner, down the street, up the block. Because as soon as we in law enforcement would take down an organization, whether it's a small group or a large group, it's only a matter of time, usually days, that they're refilled, that someone else is in that spot, An example is when I was working undercover in the early 1980s, and I would make an arrest for an ounce of heroin or a kilo of cocaine. Let me tell you something, Dave, that was a big seizure. I could almost get promoted from doing work like that. Today, a big seizure that's worthy of the press, we're looking at a ton of cocaine. We're looking at a tractor trailer load full. You've seen the news shows on TV, you got the state's attorney, you've got the police chief and the table full of dope and it's on the floor and the guns and the money and all that stuff. And that happens every day. That happens all the time across this country. And every time you see one of those dog and pony shows, there's more drugs, more guns. So that demonstrates that it's not working.
And just to think, that's only like a fraction of what's out there.
Yeah.
They found this. I mean, what about all the other stuff?
Well, and here's something else, because the cartel and others who are bringing drugs into this country now factor in, like you said, Dave, it's just a sophisticated business. They factor in what they're going to lose. They look at what they lost last year. They look at what they lost the year before, confiscated by the police, shipments that have been discovered and seized. And they factor it in, so they ship that much more now, today. Because when we take a container load, tons of cocaine off the street or heroin, They don't miss it in the street. The price doesn't fluctuate. Three, 4 decades ago, if we did that, people would be scurrying in the streets to re-up. And the prices would escalate because there'd be less drugs in the community. But today, streets don't even blink. Just keep on rolling. And that's because there's so much coming into the country. So now, after 4 decades, that we can't keep drugs out of the country. Hell, we can't even keep drugs out of our prisons. Look at what just happened in a detention center here in Baltimore. Not just drugs, but cell phones and everything else get smuggled into our prisons, and that's nothing new. We've been doing that ever since prisons have been up and running in this country. So,
and if you got the money, you can do it.
If you got the money. And that's why this guy was able to do what he did in corrupting correctional officers and getting drugs and cell phones smuggled into the detention center, because there's so much money involved. He can pay people whatever they ask to bring this stuff in. Why would anyone, and I have to say, I used to be one of these people. Now I question why I did what I did for so long, but why would anyone want a system that puts so much drugs in our communities, that's responsible for the street violence, the gun battles that we have in our communities, that's responsible for so many witness intimidation murders, that's responsible for so many overdose deaths, that's responsible for the availability of drugs to our children at every turn, on any corner, that's responsible for us spending $1.3 trillion now over 4 decades. Why would anyone want such a system for managing drugs in our communities? Not only that, there is someone, there is one organization, group of people that I know are thrilled about this system that we have in place, and that's the cartel.
Well, we're going to address that in a minute. We're going to take just a little break. You're listening to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, and my guest is Neil Franklin of Leap, and we'll be right back.